Delta Quadrant Podcast, part of the Trekmate family.
You're listening to the Delta Quadrant, a Star Trek Voyager podcast. This is a podcast where we review episodes of Star Trek Voyager in their original broadcast order. Tonight's episode is One Small Step. This is Gino in Oklahoma.
And this is Matt in Arizona.
This is Melissa from North Dakota.
And there is no Ben from Arizona, as he's having technical difficulties, actual connection issues, not Gino connection issues.
Dude, I cleaned up the break for him, so he needed to go check it out, I think.
Guys, who am I going to agree with this week?
Nobody.
This is tough for me.
You're right. You might have to stand on your own.
It's just going to be me against the world. All right.
There's no Carnivore J here. There's no Tack here to back you up.
That's right.
Oh, well.
There isn't even a Ben to be in agreement with. It's just going to be me.
Yeah. So I hope you're ready for the challenge.
I'm ready.
Because this week we are reviewing the episode One Small Step. Short synopsis. Voyager finds an ancient spacecraft, the derelict of one of humanity's first manned mission to Mars. This is the 8th episode of Season 6 of Star Trek Voyager, first aired November 17th, 1999. Get ready for a sea of writers here. Teleplay by Mike Wallager and Jessica Scott and Brian Fuller and Michael Taylor.
Wow.
So, I think that points to the quality of this episode when you have four different writers working on the script.
Good thing or bad thing? To spoil your review a little.
Well, typically, I'll just say this. Typically, when you're writing an episode or a movie and a wall of just people's names come up for the writers, not necessarily a good thing.
Okay. A little too many cooks in the kitchen type of thing.
Exactly. Story by Mike Wallager and Jessica Scott, and is directed by the Doctor, Robert Picardo. Guest stars this week include Major Baird as the computer voice and Phil Morris as Lieutenant John Kelly, who has been in Star Trek before, and I'll point that out when we get there.
Great. I was going to ask you to.
Gino, you have the notes this week, so take us into One Small Step.
One Small Step. October 19th, 2032. A small orbiter flies around Mars. And the crew talks about their morning. Suddenly, the orbiting command module experiences turbulence. An object appears. Solar flare? Nope. And that's our teaser. So, non-Voyager, but still space. And, you know, we can tell the shows are still related, so it's not a Why the Face opening.
Right. I did notice a couple of things I really enjoyed from the teaser. Did you notice that he mentioned the baseball player Bob Bacay? And that reminded me of the DS9 episode, right?
Yeah.
Because that's one of Sisko's heroes, right?
Yes.
Hey, check that out. I didn't even catch that.
And it was a reference to something Data said in one of the early Next Gen episodes about someone breaking DiMaggio's record.
Right. Yep. Also, another thing I noticed from the scene was that Kelly was wearing a wedding ring. And that jumped out at me because we don't see that very often on Star Trek.
Well,
I haven't noticed it very often.
It's either a wedding ring or an engagement ring. We don't know.
We don't know, but I mean, you don't normally see that.
Right.
There's a close up of his hand, and so I think it's, you know, you're supposed to notice it, I suppose.
Yeah,
to,
that was absolutely on purpose.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of Enterprise, the way that the inside of the command module looked.
There's more than a few things about this episode that remind me of Enterprise, but we'll get there when we get there. Would you guys like to know who this guy is?
Please.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is Phil Morris. He actually was in the original series a couple times as a little kid, but I don't want to point that out because he was like in a sea of little kids. You wouldn't be able to recognize him if I pointed him out. But where I do know him is that, think back to Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. At the very beginning of that movie, there's this one little scene where Kirk's on the bridge and some ensign comes up to him and say, "Hey, are they going to give us a ceremony when we get back?"
Yeah.
And a hero's welcome, is that what you like? Kirk says. He's that ensign, that little cadet. Yeah.
Oh, man. That whiny. Oh, man.
Are they going to give us a party when we get back? He's that guy.
They're going to celebrate us when we get home.
But more importantly, he's in a really, really good DS9 episode called Rocks and Shoals, and he plays a Jemadar third who's in charge of a unit. If you guys think back, there's an episode, it's toward the beginning of Season 6, so it's while they're off DS9, when DS9's been taken by the Dominion. Sisko and his stolen Jemadar ship end up crashing on the planet.
Oh, yes, I do remember this, and they have to swim to shore, right?
They have to swim to shore, and there's also a Jemadar unit with the dying Vorta that's on the planet. He's the Jemadar that's in charge of that unit that Sisko ends up talking to and trying to befriend and convince that he doesn't have to kill.
No, is whatever. Is that the same episode when Bashir is conflicted to make some Ketracel White?
No,
that's a different one.
That's a great episode.
That's a great episode, yep.
But he's the one who the Vorta tells him to go attack Sisko's unit, knowing that the Jemadar is going to be killed. That's a great episode. One of my favorites of DS9.
Yeah, because that's a great episode. It happens, I think, not too long, or there's kind of a callback to the episode where Nog and Garak are on the Empok Nor station, because Nog won't let Garak walk behind him.
Yes,
and
that is
Garak calls him on it, and Nog's like, you know, I don't trust you.
So you could either walk in front of me or beside me.
Exactly. Yep. And Garak, you know, he kind of not tips his hat to that. He's impressed by that. So.
Oh, that Garak.
Oh yeah.
Well, let's talk about Chakotay for a minute. Why not, right? Because on Voyager, Chakotay's doorbell is ringing like mad, but nobody is there. Is Naomi Wildman playing a game of ding-dong ditch? No! He tries to call the bridge, but signals start getting muddled. He makes his way to engineering, where Seven is making adjustments to the computer core. So we've found the problem. Or have we?
Two things. One, it's nice that we see the star date as we come back from credits, because, you know, we see the date in the beginning of the teaser, and then they give us the star date as we come back from credits. And I don't think they do that very often.
Right.
No, they don't.
So I noticed that. I thought that was nice bookending. And then there's a lot of suggestion, I think, even from this opening scene about they're trying to build something into Chakotay's character here. He's reading a book, like a book made out of paper. So he's not reading a story on an electronic pad. He's reading a book. And they kind of pan around his quarters, and you see the dream catcher on the wall, and you see the
stereotypical Indian stuff.
Exactly. It is. But again, I think they're really trying to build this appreciation of historical things into his
character, which honestly kind of bothers me, on the sense that we need Chakotay to be interested in archaeology this episode. So let's just write him that he's always been interested in archaeology and early space exploration.
Okay, but I wrote down a couple of other times where they've at least hinted, if not implied, this before. You remember the episode Emanations, where where they go over and they're looking at the
oh yeah, and he acts all sanctimonious and crap
He does, but he talks as one who has some experience with, like, looking at ancient burial sites or respecting various customs and things. So I think that's kind of an implication of his interest in history. And there was that one other episode, do you remember, where the bomb was, like, hidden inside the asteroid and it was heading at the planet? And you remember Chakotay was standing in sickbay, and he had the little hammer tool thing, and he was tapping on the rock, and they find out that the bomb thing is hidden inside of it. Do you remember this?
Yes, in fact, I remember Matt specifically saying, pay attention to this, because it's going to come into play later, but they've all of a sudden just made Chakotay fall in love with this, and he's always loved it.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of writing that bothers me.
But I pointed out in that episode when we reviewed it that this was going to be future continuity with Chakotay being interested in archaeology. And I remember pointing it out. I remember Ben saying that he thought I was really digging deep with it, but he was impressed. And so those are at least two examples where this has been hinted at before.
I don't even remember which episode that was. That's how much it stuck in my mind. And Emanations, let's just forget about that episode, shall we?
I think it might have been Rise, actually.
Probably was Rise. I think it was Rise. So, Gino agrees with me. Best forgotten.
I'm going to go down to the brig with Ben and just spend the rest of this episode there.
All right. I may end up there by the end of the episode, so.
Okay, well, you know, I do like your point about him reading a book. I think that's a nice way of them showing without telling so much that he's trying to read something and trying to seem like an intellectual. Because if he was reading something on a pad, you would think it would be work going on the ship.
Right.
So it's nice to tell that he's reading something for pleasure. So that's pretty cool. Anyway, a jolt to the ship encourages the senior staff to assemble on the bridge when they see an object emerge from subspace. Seven makes use of some Borg knowledge to entice the object to miss them. Chakotay recognizes it as the same type of object that took the command module from the Ares IV in 2032. Voyager launches a probe to check it out. So Tuvok and Seven are keeping an eye on the probe and astrometrics when they discover the core of the object contains many different compounds, including that which comprised the Ares IV command module. That means it's time for a staff meeting. And that meeting determines the Delta Flyer is going to go check on it. Seven objects, but Janeway reminds her that exploring is about more than reviewing readings from a distance.
This is where the Enterprise stuff comes in, because granted this was written way before Enterprise, but Janeway is talking a lot like Archer in this scene.
I was going to say, she even uses one of the exact same lines where she says, look, if this was just about exploration, then Starfleet would have just sent out a bunch of robotic
probes. That's exactly what Archer probes. Says.
And, yep, he says the exact same thing. I believe he says it to T'Pol.
T'Pol.
Right? Yep, exactly. Yeah. They want to see with their own eyes. This is, of course, you know, we call it a Chakotay episode, but really this is a Seven of Nine episode.
Well, the thing is I think it was supposed to be a Chakotay episode, and then the writers realized no one really likes him, and he's not very interesting, so we have to shoehorn Seven in here. You know what, honestly, and this is doubling back on something that I've said before, Seven of Nine does make episodes better for me, but in this instance, I really do feel like her storyline is shoehorned in here and fits awkward. Yes, I do. And I think it fits awkwardly with what's going on here, because this is so clearly meant to be a Chakotay episode. She has no horse in this at all. And to try to like force her to explore this as part of her humanity, I mean, it works in the moment, but I don't know, it just feels so artificially shoehorned in here.
See, I thought it worked well for two reasons. One, the first and most important is just that I really like what she experiences and what she learns in this episode. I just really like that. But secondly, I thought it kind of worked because they're creating this tension, maybe not creating it so much as ratcheting it up, the tension between her and Chakotay. I don't know if at this point they know that they're going to be putting them in a relationship together or not. It seems like it would be pointing to that in the future. You know, it seems like a basis for that.
I think that's retconning it, quite honestly. And here, I just think they have no chemistry. I'm already going to tell you, they're the worst couple in all of Star Trek.
I don't disagree with you on that. But they are an interesting, like, I think had they had some chemistry, they would be an interesting couple, because she is this complete pragmatist. She doesn't, you know, she is just not grasping at all the concept of, I want to hold that rock with my own hands, or has some sort of sentimental value. She is not into that at all. And whereas Chakotay is really, they're showing him as the historian, the appreciator of history and myth and all of these things. He's the opposite of that. So could have been interesting.
It could have been interesting if Beltran could actually manage to express some passion about a subject that his character is supposedly passionate about. Every time he opens his mouth in this episode and talks about how supposedly he loves this mission and, you know, admires these people, he says it with all the conviction of someone who just, you know, took a sedative. It's terrible.
You really don't see a whole lot of conviction coming from him. I thought that the feelings I got from him were anger first, or kind of a stubborn anger, and then he's just kind of whiny after that.
Don't even get me started when we get to a later scene.
In and of himself, it's hard for me to defend his actions in this episode, but I guess I like them as the catalyst for what Seven experienced because of them.
I'm thinking that that shift in his attitude there really comes from being chopped up with the writing, because he's really... I mean, throughout most of this episode, he's acting from a bed. And I think that came around to when the writer said, you know, we better make this more than just a Chakotay episode. Let's throw Seven in here because it's going to be
interesting. I'm sure he took it, you know, personally and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, I get it. I get it that your episode turned into a Seven episode. But like I said, it's something that we were saying the other day. I mean, you're an actor doing a job. So that means even if you're not happy with the script, you don't act it poorly. You give it all you got. That's being a professional. So, no, I'm not going to defend him with this. He has no passion behind any of the things he's saying. And that it needs it. We need to understand. We need to understand that this means something to him, and he never convinces me of that. You know, whenever, I know it's unfair to compare the two, but since they both share an interest in archaeology, whenever Picard would go on some sort of archaeological thing, Patrick Stewart convinced me that it was a passionate pastime of his.
Mm-hmm. Well, they try to do something like that right here with the next scene when Chakotay and Paris are reviewing what they know about the Ares IV and astrometrics. You know, they're both kind of like, oh, hey, you're a history buff too. Cool, great. So it's agreed that Seven's going to come along, too. She goes to get an inoculation in sickbay, where the doctor plies her with his envy that she gets to go and asks her to take a few holo images. And then we get some more of Seven's development of the story. It's like she doesn't really care about the sentimental value of this entire trip, and everybody else is like, this is really cool, you get to go, and you're not excited about it. Why the face? So the flyer is off. It enters the anomaly, and they punch through to the core. Inside, they find a wondrous, stable environment. Even Seven is mildly impressed. It's not all fun and games, though. Their time inside is limited. So the away team gets to work searching for the Ares IV module and to get some readings.
You know, just to go back to what you were saying about the scene in Astrometrics, Gino, Beltran's not convincing me at all, but for whatever reason, and he's supposed to be passionate, but less passionate than Chakotay, McNeil is convincing me more than Beltran is.
Oh, yeah, he really went for it this week, and I think it showed.
He does. I mean, his facial expressions throughout this episode are really powerful. And he conveys especially that bittersweet emotion that we get towards the end. I think he conveys it much better than Beltran does.
I mean, honestly, if because we've seen him take a shining to 20th and 21st century history, I wouldn't have minded in the slightest if this passion project was one of Tom's and not Chakotay's. It probably would have been better.
Honestly, I'm kind of glad it wasn't, because that would have been a rehashing of a story we've seen a couple times.
Yeah, but it would have been a story that I would be more interested in. I don't know.
I'm glad it wasn't, though, Matt, because I think it would have been more complicated. I mean, Tom is supposed to be in this relationship. He's not very far away from getting married here to B'Elanna. So for him to make
spoilers,
the call of their lives... What's that?
I said spoilers, thanks.
Oh, sorry. So for him to make the call for them to risk their lives for this ship, I mean, I think we would have hated him even more for making that decision. I'm not going to defend Chakotay at all for making that decision. I think it was clearly the wrong decision.
Well, I think Paris is, that's par for the course for him, because he's a little daredevilish. And then when he gets inside, he even calls to B'Elanna on the bridge, and he's like, no, this is great. So we may that relationship is happening.
The thing is, we may have not admired the decision for it, but at least I could go with Tom more, because that's within his character to get so wrapped up in something to not listen to the captain. It's way out of left field for what Chakotay does later, and honestly makes me hate the character even more.
Oh, yeah, way out of the left field, especially for a first officer.
It is. You're right.
Okay, so below in the flyer, Seven and Chakotay are talking about their childhood dreams when Paris has found the orbiter. You'll notice I skipped over that little scene because it's a lot of, I wanted to be a paleontologist when I was 6 years old. Well, Seven wanted to be a ballerina.
No dream is
too big.
Yeah, but I wanted to mention that because I think that seems a little bit inconsistent with what we saw in Tattoo, where we see him as a young man and he's pestering his dad about wanting... And he's telling his dad, I signed up for Starfleet without you even knowing it. And so that seems kind of inconsistent with what he's telling us here, that, well, you know, when I was a kid, I always wanted to be a paleontologist, but things like Starfleet got in the way. So, I don't know. Didn't that seem kind of inconsistent to you?
Inconsistent.
Well, they don't care.
Maybe the Sky Spirits got it wrong.
Right, well, that episode's terrible, but... But the thing was, no one cares about Chakotay's continuity, at least of all the writers. So they're not even, when they try to give him character, they're not even succeeding, so whatever.
You know, I think it's just, it goes back to another inconsistency. I would have really liked a solid, just the same group of writers throughout the entire show. I know that's not the way that Star Trek works, but yeah, you get a lot more consistency with your characters that way. Because we've seen several different versions of each of our characters, and this is a Chakotay we've seen before, but not all the time. And that's what bugs me.
You know what, though? It may not be the way Star Trek works generally, but with Next Gen and then especially DS9, you have executive producers and permanent writing staff that oversaw everything that other writers came in and did to keep it consistent. You know, I just feel like on Voyager there's no oversight. They're just coasting on goodwill at this point because they're the only Star Trek show on the air. And I think honestly what led to part of Star Trek's downfall in the early 2000s was that they just took everything for granted. Like they thought they would get by on the name alone. And
sure.
No, you really need the writing there to back up the name. Otherwise, it's just empty.
So after a long, thoughtful conversation between Chakotay and Seven, Paris has found the module, but the anomaly is on a collision course for a dark matter asteroid, and they're ordered to leave. I was a little confused by the technobabble we got just before we realized it was a dark matter asteroid.
Yeah, well,
Harry and Janeway and B'Elanna.
The technobabble is flying fast and furious in this episode, as it is with this Voyager.
A dark matter asteroid, really? Does that even make any sense?
I have no idea, Melissa. If I had a physicist, Sub-Zero or Seraki or somebody, if you could explain this to me, go ahead. But it's just like, technical BS anomaly is going to run into this anomaly and do something with it. And
yeah,
I didn't care much beyond what the surface level was. It's like, this is way over my head, or it's just completely made up.
Yeah.
But
it's here to create tension because Janeway's like, get out of there. And Chakotay's like, no, I want the module. So he orders Paris to tractor the module, even though Janeway's like, GTFO.
That's an order, by the way. It wasn't a request to get out of there.
And so he tractors the module. It, of course, slows down the flyer, and the anomaly collides with the dark matter asteroid before they can exit. Chakotay is inevitably injured, and the flyer is crippled, and the anomaly's heading back to subspace.
Well, that was going to happen anyway, but the fact is that they would have had enough time to get out of there had their ship been working.
Right.
So let's break this down for a second, huh? So there's this technical BS asteroid coming to collide with the anomaly. It's not going to disperse the anomaly. It's just going to collide with it. So I don't get what the real urgency is here. Why can't you just leave, let it collide, and then go back in and get the module?
Well, they even said they didn't know what the effect would be of a dark matter asteroid hitting it. And
I don't believe that.
I mean, that's technobabble on top of your technobabble. So
great.
It's there just to say there's a tense situation and they need to get out now.
It's bad enough that they make up a dark matter asteroid. You know, I don't need technobabble on top of technobabble.
So, like, as we noted last week, if I had written the notes for this episode, for this section, I would have just said, magic wands were waved, and now back to the conversations.
Yeah. But I think one of the main things it does for this scene is this gives us a change in our protagonist per se for the episode.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't become a Chakotay episode anymore. Now it's a Seven episode. Because Seven has to step up, and you know, she is down below in the flyer. Now, I'm not sure how the Delta Flyer is set up, but I'm thinking all this with Chakotay on the like meta bed and everything are down below.
It is. You see the little staircase in the back. You take that little staircase up. You're in the command cockpit or whatever you want to call it.
Okay. Good. Good. Good.
It's kind of like you remember the one time in Next Gen where we actually got to see the back of a runabout.
Yeah.
You know, we see these runabouts all the time in DS9. We only see the front cockpit, but there's that one Next Gen episode where everything's frozen, where you mm-hmm. get to see the backside of a runabout, and there's actually like a table there and stuff like that. So it's similar to this.
Cool. All right, so Voyager eventually gets in contact with the Flyer using a probe, and B'Elanna determines that a distributor aboard the Ares IV command module may be useful to the Flyer.
Now, so, this really strange credulity, a 200-plus, no, not even 200, 300-year-old thing is going to fit perfectly into this 24th century Federation/Borg, because let's not forget that 7 of 9 added Borg enhancements to this Delta Flyer when they built it. It's going to be perfectly compatible, this 300-year-old thing, and do just exactly what it needs to.
Look, everybody knows that all technology in the Star Trek universe, be it Romulan, human, Ferengi, or whatever...
But this doesn't come from the Star Trek universe. This comes from our time. 2032 is 18 years from now when we record this in 2014.
True, so, but I would argue that it's less... It's more believable that our own past technology would work than it is to believe that our technology would work with a completely alien race.
Once you see the way that they hook it up later, this thing is acting as a distributor manifold. So it's just focusing power from one way into another system by funneling, essentially. And it looks like it's working wirelessly. So.
But the kind of energy it's funneling didn't exist when it was...
Sure, it's true. Sure. But I'm going to give it a pass. I don't think that's really a failing of the episode. That's just more kind of like, this is our solution, let's move forward.
Look, here's the thing. With the technobabble, I've always made the rule that, you know what, I can go with it up to a point. And, you know, up to this point, I've had dark matter asteroids, and now, you know, the whole MacGuffin of this episode is an anomaly that burrows in and out of subspace. That's a big gimme for me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I see that at the beginning, I'm like, okay... So this is the basis of the episode, so I'm not going to ask questions about the anomaly. And then I'm not supposed to ask questions about the dark matter asteroid, clearly. And then I'm not supposed to ask questions about this distributor thing working perfectly. So, you know, I can go with it up to a point, but not, you're really, like, trying my patience by the end
That's
of it.
That's a good point. You know, you're drawing a line between suspension of disbelief and questioning nothing in an episode of Star Trek, a very cerebral show. So, yeah,
right.
You're making a lot of sense there. So, Seven, our new protagonist,
wait,
is going
before, to... Before we get to this, we need to talk about this scene, because it really bothers me. When Melissa, I know you favor Chakotay over Janeway almost, like, 100% of the time.
Yep.
But Janeway, in this instance, gave an order to leave. It was unequivocal. And it wasn't the necessarily wrong call, as we see from what happens to the Flyer. Correct?
Oh, yeah. So, no, I agree with your order.
So on his own, just because he can't leave his precious module behind, he puts everybody's lives in danger and stays. And then, you know, I wrote down everything that bothered me one by one. So, number one, Chakotay disobeys a direct order from a superior officer. Okay? And then when he regains consciousness... Is the first thing he asks, is everyone all right, or how's the ship? No, that would be requiring him to take his duty seriously. Instead, it's paraphrasing here, OMG, what happened to the command module? So.
Okay, but here's...
Wait, no, I'm not done yet.
Okay, go ahead.
Doesn't give a damn about anybody's lives, just wants to make sure that the command module's okay. And then, you know, Seven, who is rightfully angry, tells him exactly what's going on, and then he has the nerve to act all superior and say, oh, lose the attitude. And I'm like, you know what? I can't say what I said to my screen on air because it was just profanity laden, but, you know, I just have what a petulant, disloyal, arrogant, selfish little F of a person. And then instead of apologizing, he basically just shrugs his shoulders and makes a snide joke to Seven. Like, I really... This episode just epitomizes why I hate this character. Not just, like, actively hate this character.
Yeah, we get something right there that you mentioned that I've skipped over. Earlier in the episode, when Chakotay approaches Seven about her changes to the computer system, she makes a joke about Voyager not being ready for assimilation, and then she says, oh, the doctor told me to defuse situations with humor. And then Chakotay kind of turns it back on her here.
But nobody's lives were at risk when Seven did it.
I kind of feel a little bit like an earlier episode when we were kind of up in arms about Chakotay giving the resistance is futile kind of Snark to Seven Then, and I think it's kind of the same thing. It's, I don't know if it's being, like, aggressively flirty, you know, like the guy that punches the girl in the arm, but I don't know. Come on,
Jeff. If it's supposed to be flirty, what a stupid-ass time for it.
Matt, so, number one, I don't disagree with any of the things on your list. I think he in fact, did all of those things, and that they were disappointing and annoying and all of those things. The difference, I think, is that Janeway has also done every single one of those things. Now, she hasn't disobeyed a superior officer because she doesn't have one, but she certainly disobeyed her own superior, you could say, principle or directive, if you want to point out some of the times that she's, you know, gone against the prime directive to do something.
Or the Omega directive.
Right. Okay, so she's done every single one of those things that Chakotay has done. The difference is that when Janeway does it, we never see a crew member who comes back at her angry like Seven did with Chakotay. Though we have actually seen her look at other crew members and say, I don't like your attitude, get over it. Even when Janeway is clearly doing something that's questionable, like we saw in Equinox, for example. So we never get that satisfaction. And you do get that satisfaction in this episode because Seven is really speaking for us at that point and saying, you idiot, you screwed up.
He tells her to lose it, and then, you know, the conversation's pretty much over at that point. And
we do get the admission from Chakotay later that he did make the wrong decision. He says
way down the line.
But he admits it. We never get that satisfaction from Janeway. When did Janeway say, you know what, I screwed up here.
I've not defended Janeway at every decision she made, but at least...
No, but I'm saying that every one of these things that really annoys you about Chakotay in this episode, and they annoy me too, are things that we've also seen Janeway do in a command situation. And you never get those satisfactions from her, and I think that's why I just can't like her as a character anymore after a while.
I'm going to point out the difference between Janeway and Chakotay for me, at least. I think with Chakotay, I've already not liked his character, number one. Mm-hmm. And number two, I think I mentioned in this episode how I feel like, despite some maybe past quick references to it, I feel like his interest in this archaeology, and specifically this period of space exploration, feels very artificial and forced, mm-hmm. and not authentic at all. So, his reasons for disobeyment really don't make any sense to me, because he's not sold me on the passion. He's not sold me on pretty much anything in this episode.
Sure.
With Janeway, I agree she's made very questionable decisions, and I agree anyone should have been more challenging to her. The fact that she goes 7 years without any sort of challenge, when clearly the show was made for conflict, if you put like half the crew as Maquis in charge, but
right.
That's a whole other complaint that I have. But she should have been challenged at some point. But I think the important difference for me is when Janeway's made those wrong decisions, I see where she's coming from, and I get she's selling on why she makes them. They feel authentic, they feel in the moment, and they feel real.
Mm-hmm.
Chakotay's doesn't feel real, and it just feels annoying.
I'm most often not sold on Janeway's arguments for why she does the things she does. So I understand that, because I don't usually buy her motivations either. I mean, I don't buy them because they're not well acted. I just don't buy them because I think they're bogus. I think they're just simply not well thought out.
And that's fair, but I think the double whammy for me is here I think Chakotay's actions are bogus and not well acted. I mean, sure. At least with Mulgrew, you get good acting.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
True.
So, through all of this, Chakotay's injured, so he can't go over. Seven's going to go over, so Chakotay gives her a little, get what data files you can. He's still all about this orbiter. Mm-hmm. So Seven hops over, finds active logs for the module's commander in his time inside the anomaly. So Harris encourages her just to let it play. So as Seven attempts to remove the distributor, we see logs of a man on his own in space.
This is the part of the episode that saves it for me.
Yes. Oh, this is beautiful. I was just going to ask. I totally bought this actor's, bought into his presentation of this character.
More so than Chakotay, and I'm going to say even more so than Seven, a character that I love.
Yeah.
Kelly is the star of the episode for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So Here we go. He continues his exploration and even sees the remnants of another spacecraft. His realization that we're not alone is coupled with the reality that his situation is dire. We see another log of his attempt to escape the anomaly. His attempt fails, and he realizes this will be his final resting place. His last request is that whoever finds him takes the data he has acquired. His one regret is that he never found out who won the World Series.
Heart-wrenching. Heart-wrenching stuff.
Oh. It's really good, and it's basically just a monologue. He's not acting against anything.
And the fact that he's like half talking to his dad, half talking to Mission Control, heart-wrenching.
He's kind of delirious at the end.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good stuff, and honestly, I mean, I'm not going to spoil my score yet, but it started off low, but this part of it made it go higher.
Mm-hmm.
We'll just get the rush to the finish here. Seven frees the distributor, downloads the data from the command module. She's running out of time, but does everything in the time needed. She attaches her comm badge to Lieutenant Kelly's remains and transport both herself and the astronaut back to the flyer. Some quick work with the distributor gets the flyer going, and they get running and escape the anomaly in just the nick of time with some help from Voyager and a tractor beam. Which, it was a pretty cool scene. I mean, it was tense, but you kind of knew they were going to make it.
Yeah. Sure.
Anyway, our final scene is the memorial for the fallen lieutenant. Janeway honors his spirit and bravery. Seven shares that before, he may have otherwise been insignificant. She realizes how they were alike and places a hand on his casket, softly saying the words, "Yankees in six games." The multiple times I watched this episode, I found myself getting choked up at that scene.
I cried the first time I saw it.
Look, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that this is a bad scene at all. I do feel like I still stand by my belief that the 709 aspect of the story feels incredibly forced and shoehorned in. That's not to say Jerry Ryan doesn't act it well, because she always acts everything well. And this last scene just kind of exemplifies that. But again, I kind of feel like Chakotay's story wasn't that important. Seven's story kind of feels forced. The starter, like I said, for me in this episode is Kelly. Mm-hmm. And he's only in the beginning and the end.
So there you have it. That's the episode. Let's get into it.
I want to say about the ending, though, I really think that the reason they didn't do it, because in a sense it would maybe just have not fit, but there should have been a scene where Chakotay and Janeway had a conversation. I mean, or I guess you have to imagine that in the background in some way. I mean, there should have been. He didn't follow her orders. He disobeyed her orders, and he risked the lives of three of her crew. And there's no resolution to that.
I see what you're saying, but this episode, when they decided wasn't going to be a Chakotay episode, I'm sure they just swept that under the rug, because we're still trying to repair Janeway's character right here.
Uh-huh.
So we still don't get a lot of Janeway. She's just being straight out your captain. She's not one side or other of the fence. And seeing her dress somebody down right now is still kind of a bad idea.
Well, here's the thing, guys. I mean, I feel like Chakotay disobeying the orders wasn't even that needed. With all the techno stuff they come up with, they could have just had, we're trying to get out, but at the last minute we didn't quite make it. We still got hit with the asteroid. We're back in the center.
Yeah, that's such a good point, Matt. You're absolutely right. For the story to work the way it did, it really wasn't necessary. Other than maybe, I mean, if you think about the interactions between Chakotay and Janeway since Equinox, it's kind of been a parting of ways almost. I mean, don't you think like they've almost been getting further and further apart?
Well, the thing is, we haven't seen enough of them for me to make that decision, Melissa. I mean, if we think about the episodes that come before this, I mean, Chakotay's there, he's doing his job, but he's a background.
Sure.
So, like, they haven't focused on it. Now, if they had done DS9 writing, as I'd like to put it, and they had shown me a strained relationship since Equinox, that could have been interesting.
Right.
And that could have worked that way, but we've had no evidence, I mean, because he's not there. He's doing his job in the background, and Janeway's the star. There's nothing you can write it that way, but you know, it's to paraphrase Ben. It's digging deep.
So you know, beautiful story really with the death of Kelly and seeing the sacrifice that he made and just what he went through in the end. But what do you think of Seven's growth in this episode? Was this a necessary lesson for her?
I think it humanizes her a little bit more. And if, as Voyager is infamous for not following the breadcrumbs they lay down for themselves. If this was to be followed, she would be more excited about things.
Sure.
And embrace things with more emotion. But I have a feeling we're still going to get the emotionless, calculated Seven.
You are correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, because like if you compare this, for example, again, we had a very similar conversation between Archer and T'Pol early in that season about the value of seeing things with our own eyes and being explorers. You did see some of that development with T'Pol over that
yes.
series. And I don't think we're going to see that same thing here.
No, and this is, again, just, well, first of all, congrats, Gino. You've now anticipated what Voyager does. You've gotten a sense of how the writing works on this show.
It only took him 6 seasons.
Right? I'm already building a cynicism, sadly.
And in a way, I kind of regret that because I know this is your first time. I don't want you to approach these episodes cynically, but it has to be pointed out that this is how writing works on this show.
Sure.
But you know something? Even though I know what's going to happen at the very end of the show, spoiler alert, folks, Voyager's going to get home. And we're recording this just after the 4th of July, so mm-hmm. any Star Trek site you see is going to post a picture with fireworks, which is going to be Voyager over the Golden Gate Bridge with fireworks.
Right.
Yes, but that picture, you haven't seen the last episode yet, right?
Right.
So I'll just say that. Let's say that picture is not exactly what it seems.
Yeah, okay. It's not.
Well, that image, just knowing that Voyager is going to get home, I don't know, something about that just makes me really happy.
But you know what?
Their goal.
You already got spoiled with it because your favorite film, Star Trek Nemesis, Admiral Janeway is already there giving
right.
Picard orders.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, Gino, I have to tell you, my biggest disappointment with this entire series is that I don't think they ever should have gotten home.
What?
Yep, so that's going to be...
Well, this is a discussion that we're going to have in...
Yep.
I'll just say this much. I think... I mean, not to spoil the Endgame podcast, but I think it's... I'll take half a dozen of another Melissa. I don't agree that they shouldn't have gotten home because if I'm watching a show for 7 years where the goal is to get home and then they never get home, part of me would feel dramatically unfulfilled.
Okay, but do you remember the end of Quantum Leap?
That's another dramatically unfulfilled show, to be honest with you. That's kind of the definition of anticlimactic.
Did Sliders end? Did anybody watch Sliders all the way through?
No.
I don't know. I kind of fizzled out. I think it might have been on Netflix at one time, but the order that they have it is out of production order, so that really kind of got me in the first season.
Oh.
I don't know.
But spoil us. Actually, I think it's on Netflix, Gina.
Yeah, but, I'm not going to watch that whole show.
Right. But... So I think it would have been anticlimactic for me had they not gotten home, but the way that they got home was just talk about forced.
Right.
I mean, I'll just say this much: Endgame is not my favorite Star Trek finale by a long shot.
Well, I don't want to talk too much about the end of the show. We haven't made it there yet, but I feel like it kind of goes against what Star Trek really started out as: this exploration, and our mission is ongoing when mm-hmm. the mission of Voyager has a terminus, essentially. You know,
right.
When they get home, the mission is over.
Right.
So, yeah.
You know, one thing just in reflecting, to get us back to this episode, which we seem to be doing everything we can to not talk about, I think that I was thinking about it today that these scenes that we see with Kelly in this ship, you know, this is... I don't know if they knew that Enterprise was coming yet when they were filming it, when they were writing this and when we were seeing this, but to me, it almost seems like a test pilot for what they were going to do with Enterprise because, you know, you do get this real sense of emotional connection to this guy, you know, on this ship and what he does and doesn't have to work with, and I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, I think when we talked to Larry a few weeks ago when he was on Survival Instinct, I think he did discuss that during this sixth season they already had Enterprise in mind. It was in development.
Okay.
And so I think they already had the idea for Enterprise, and maybe this was sort of testing the waters. But from what I understood from our conversation with him, it's an active development. And then, you know, Brannon Braga is going to leave Voyager at the end of this season, handing the last season over to somebody else so he can go actively write for Enterprise and get the show ready.
Right, and didn't Larry mention as well that they were kind of tossing out different ideas? Because I think it's interesting that, so here in this episode we have almost a preview of what Enterprise is going to look like, and then in a couple of episodes we're going to have Pathfinder, which is, you know, kind of set back on Earth, and we've got Academy politics and Starfleet headquarters politics. And
yeah, I mean, I think Pathfinder was more written with Voyager in mind than Enterprise, but...
Well, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that because, you know, another idea that was being toyed with around the time was doing another series that would have been set, you know, about Starfleet headquarters or about the Academy or...
Right. Well, you know, speaking of going back a little bit, one thing I noticed in this episode we didn't get much or any of, for that matter, was seeing the knobs and controls and stuff on the Delta Flyer. I mean, the shots of controls we did get were very Star Trek-y, you know, Elkar's panels and that stuff.
Well, that's probably to illustrate the difference between the command module of the Ares IV and the Delta Flyer.
That's a great point. And, you know, but something else along those lines, along the directing, sorry to keep cutting you off, Matt, but I did notice one thing when we're on the bridge showing a lot of tension here. We had a lot of shots of Janeway moving around the bridge, and the camera's following her, and somebody's just got it up on their shoulder because you see it bounce a little bit. But yeah, there's all that tension and really kind of exploring the space of the bridge, and I think a lot of that has to do with Picardo's directing in this episode.
Yeah,
the camera's always kind of moving in this episode, especially when Janeway's walking around the bridge and moves up to where B'Elanna's sitting at the helm, and it was kind of interesting to see B'Elanna at the helm.
Yeah.
I think this is a much better directorial effort on Picardo's part than his first episode that he directed, which was...
What was his first episode?
Alter Ego.
I was going to say that, the Jekyll and Hyde Doctor.
No, not Jekyll and Hyde Doctor. Harry Kim falls in love with a hologram.
Right, yeah. Now, I did think that, I mean, I understand why it was necessary, but it was almost unfortunate that they had to keep panning back and forth between Chakotay's reaction shots and McNeil's reaction shots as they're listening to the log of the man dying. Just because, you know, again, Paris, you just really see that he's hurting for that man as he's dying. And there's just less of a reaction on Chakotay's face. And they kept going, did you notice that? They would go back and forth.
Yeah, I think to me a little bit, I don't know, I might be playing too much into it, but I got a little bit of cynicism from Chakotay of, like, think about all this data that we're going to be getting, and, oh, yeah, that guy died.
Yeah.
No, but you know, that wouldn't work, because supposedly he's so passionate about this man was one of his heroes, blah, 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 whatever he says. You never see it, obviously, on his face. Paris, McNeil is selling me.
Yeah.
You know. That's why I say I think he's doing a better job at this passion thing than Chakotay is, but, you know, that's because Robert Duncan McNeil is a much better actor. So it's interesting that this could have been a test run for what Enterprise was, and we're going to get something similar, Melissa, you know, in Season 7 when we get to that Friendship 1 episode.
Right.
I think that's another sort of early space exploration sort of idea. But we'll get there in Season 7. Mm-hmm. But right now we're going to talk about the Season 6 episode and wrap up our final thoughts. So, Melissa, you go first. What are your final thoughts on One Small Step and your score out of 5?
Okay, well, I'm going to try and be really upbeat here because I know I'm going to have the kindest review. There were definitely things to love about this episode. I loved all of the scenes where we were watching the logs, watching that experience of Kelly trapped in this ship, knowing he's going to die, came off as very heroic and very sympathetic. I thought that was just really well done. And I also really enjoyed Seven's performance in this episode. I thought you could see her learning something, and I believed that she had really learned to appreciate something that she never would have appreciated before by the time she got to the end of this experience. I totally bought that. So that was really, really well done. I am the Chakotay defender on this podcast, and like I said before, I think he made the wrong decisions, and I think that he was really kind of a pain in the butt all the way through this episode. But the one good thing I can say is that because of his actions, we got to see a lot of good things happen with Kelly and with Seven. So that's my defense of Chakotay in this episode. I'm going to give it, you know, this is low on the Melissa scale, but I'll give it 4 out of 5 stars.
Yeah, that low. God, you really must have hated it.
Yeah.
So, Gino, you go next.
You know, I like the things you said there, Melissa, and I love hearing you say pain in the butt because it's just funny. I enjoyed this episode overall. At the end of the episode, I was emotionally invested, and it paid off. So that turned out well, but I see what you're talking about, Matt, with the flurry of writers here, and it knowing how these Star Trek episodes have been formulated, I can see that this probably started out as something completely different and was molded in a couple different ways, and because of that, we had a lot of loose ends, and I don't know, that bothers me a little, but to coin a phrase from Matt or other people in the universe, I don't know. At the end of the day, it's a Star Trek episode that it met its goal, even though that goal may have been different from the inception of the episode. I enjoyed the acting, and I'm glad it wasn't a Chakotay focused on a Kuchamoya. 7 episodes are always great, but Lieutenant Kelly really stole the show, and I like what they did with the scenery and a couple of different things. Even after talking about the episode and all the downsides to it, I enjoyed it, and I would watch it again, so I'm also going to give it 4 stars.
Wow, I'm really kind of surprised. I mean, happily surprised, but wow.
No, Gino's kind of like, Gino's always the best gauge of these episodes, quite frankly, because he's totally unbiased.
Sure.
When it comes to these later ones, having never seen them before, I'm jaded. And that obviously comes through in a lot of my reviews, and I try not to be, but I can't help it. I've seen these episodes so many times. But I don't want to reiterate too much of what I said, beating a dead horse, but Beltran doesn't work for me in this episode. His supposed passion behind this archaeology just isn't there for me. He's not selling me on the acting. McNeil's good, pretty good. Jeri Ryan's always fantastic, and I agree that she does a bang-up job, especially at the end. But, again, I feel like her story is kind of contrived and forced in here because they didn't want this to be a Chakotay episode. So let's figure out a way to get Seven in here. That's kind of how it comes across to me in story structure. But it's done very well. What saves this episode for me is, like I said, with Kelly, and especially his monologue at the end is very, very moving, very touching. Saves what I considered a very mediocre episode. Not terrible. I want to say that. It's not terrible. The story structure itself works rudimentarily. I don't know. Very rudimentary story structure, it works. You know, there's going to be episodes later this season, Melissa, Fury, where it takes the concepts of Voyager that we've seen before and twists them to make no sense whatsoever. This is not that, so that's good. But it was very mediocre for me. It was very middle of the road. Nothing was really grabbing me. Not even Seven was really grabbing me. But Kelly sold me. So with that in mind, I'm gonna, what would have been a 2.5 for me is gonna be bumped up to a 3.5, conditionally, based on Kelly.
Still not too bad, considering all the down points you pointed out about this episode and all the things you had to overlook. I think Kelly really saved the episode from being trash, I think.
Yes. And like I said, there's going to be much worse story structure because I may be in Fury when we get to Fury.
I can't wait till we talk about that because honestly, I want to have an honest conversation about what were they even thinking when they wrote that? I mean, what were they thinking?
Okay. I'm not going to say what the episode's about, Gino, but you're not going to like it for a very specific reason. But there's other reasons on top of the reason that you're not going to like it, why it's a terrible episode.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll keep my glimpses open until then.
Welcome to the feedback section for this week. We are going to read the comments on our episode of Riddles. Starting off here with Sarecki, who says, working on brevity this week after listening to myself on Alice. In honor of this being Roxanne's first episode as a director, here's a link to the June 12th Directors Guild of America Latino Committee conversation between Miguel Arteta, Norberto Barba, Roxanne Dawson, Linda Mendoza. I thought it was great. They discussed directing and diversity. For those who don't know, Roxanne Dawson has been a director-producer since Voyager ended. Side note, Jesus Salvador Trevino was there. He's directed several episodes of Voyager, so Sorecki has provided links to all these things, so go check them out on the forum if you're interested.
At forum.trekmatefamily.com.
She goes on to say, I neither loved nor skipped this episode, so I give it a 3 out of 5. I want to like it more. The acting was great. The parallels to Alzheimer's / dementia / brain trauma were good, but I think that there is too much Neelix in this episode for me to enjoy it, even though this is the new and improved Neelix. I guess I still can't do a Neelix episode. Also, like Ben, I have a hard time getting sad / sentimental, so the episode didn't hit me like it did Melissa. I believe I would have liked it more if it had. However, I really enjoyed your discussion of this episode, and it made me appreciate it more than I did before. Side note, how the hell would you get enough information about the cloaking frequency from the sinusoid on that cake? It's just a squiggle.
She's right.
Matt mentioned how Neelix not only helped Tuvok with his lost memories, but also helped B'Elanna in Workforce Part 2. Interestingly, both of these episodes were directed by Roxanne Dawson. From the comments section, when Melissa reads my comments, she makes me seem so much nicer than I am. And she answers a question that, was it you that put forward this question, Gino?
Yes, I've posed this question through several different Star Trek forum-related places, and Sorecki, you're the only person to ever answer it, and upon that, with so much information that my mind is blown.
Right, so we wanted to know, was there anybody in Star Trek who had worn all three colors? And she goes on to say that Tom wore all three colors, yellow in worst-case scenario, and blue in author-author. Both times he was on the holodeck for that, but still wore all three colors. Robert Ricardo, not the Doctor, not always playing the Doctor, has worn all three. In The Swarm, he played Zimmerman and wore gold. And
well, so, you know, the Doctor was based on Zimmerman, so there you go.
Right, and of course we have the Doctor, who wears blue, and now the ECH, who wears the red.
So I did respond to this and, you know, asked if it was just related to those two Voyager characters, and she did go into more detail, but I'll let you read that at forum.trekmatefamily.com.
But basically, I think she's right. I think it's only those two. There's plenty of characters who've worn two colors, but not all three.
Well, she does mention Harry also, if you count some future stuff that may or may not have happened. Anyway.
Harry doesn't deserve a credit as wearing all three.
So next up we have a comment from Professor Sub-Zero who says, two major thoughts on this pleasant three-star episode. First, did it strike anybody as Neelix's interactions with Tuvok were a little more than just friendship? It looked like Neelix wanted to be noticed, respected, and dare I say, loved by Tuvok. I definitely read the loss Neelix was experiencing when the Doctor healed Tuvok as him realizing his love will never be reciprocated. Crazy? Put Tank Girl in Neelix's spot. Have her act the same way and tell me it wasn't somebody experiencing the loss of a potential romantic partner.
I think you're reading a little too much into it.
All right, well, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I know some cast members on Star Trek have expressed their disappointment that the show never really bothered to delve into relationships beyond traditional heterosexual ones. For every The Outcast, there are a million examples where it's just ignored. Showrunners would promise to include a gay character every show version, and magically, it had never happened. From TNG right up through Enterprise. It'd be awesome if Ethan Phillips intentionally pushed the performance to the bi end of the spectrum to subversely ship some topics in that Trek has shamefully ignored. Or I'm totally misreading things. Second thought. I've mentioned before about my relative disinterest in Vulcans. Spock was awesome because he had great foils, struggled with his half-humanity at times, and let's face it, they played fast and loose with some character stuff then. He had plenty of emotions. Tuvok is the opposite. I don't mind Neelix, but he doesn't match Bones, and Tuvok faces no struggles. He is perfectly content with being a Vulcan, and he is good at it. He isn't all that annoyed by Neelix ultimately, and he isn't all that tempted by Tank Girl. That translates to him being a super stagnated character to me. He simply won't change. And that equates to boredom on my part. I know he faces some medical stuff down the line, but that's a discussion for a later.
And I kind of want to agree with Professor Sub-Zero here, and I can say this now that Ben's not here, but it's not that I dislike Tuvok, but I think for me he's the least interesting of all the Vulcan characters we've gotten in Star Trek, because exactly what Professor Sub-Zero said, he's full Vulcan. Really has no problems being full Vulcan. Neelix is okay, but he doesn't have that great other partner like Spock did with Bones. So he really doesn't have any struggle. And I kind of, Vulcans are really kind of boring. I mean, when you really boil down to it.
They Spock are kind of one note, you know.
Spock was interesting because of the half-human aspect in Bones, and they even play that more up so with Zachary Quinto's version of Spock, which is going in a really interesting direction because of the way they've taken that universe. So they made that character interesting. And T'Pol experimented with emotions, and that made her interesting.
Yeah.
So.
All right, well, he continues. I'd have loved to see them do something truly interesting and not cure him at the end. I think there could have been tremendous dramatic opportunity to show him change and struggle with a new place and role on the ship. Russ shows me enough interesting moments where I'd like to see him out of the Vulcan shell. Does he end up being like Cybok? Sorry for the Trek 5 reference. Or does he revert to appreciating why Vulcans suppress their emotions? Whatever. At least it'd give some direction to a character that doesn't have one, in my opinion. Plus, it'd be new and different. But, oh wait! And then he put in a picture here of a Nintendo reset button, which I really appreciate, by the way, Professor. That's an NES reset button.
You really appreciate it, but Ben took great umbrage to insisting that the episode had a reset button.
Voyager. What else are you going to do? The
problem is he refuses to acknowledge that it does. I mean, yes, there is some change within the episode, but it's so contained. Next week, he's back to being Tuvok as if nothing happened. So, you know.
And that's your episodic television downfall. I keep saying this, and sorry to beat that pile of hairy mush that was once a horse, but come on. I mean, your episodic television is always going to have to end on the same note it started on. And, you know, with evolved audiences like we are now, it's just a disappointment.
And I know you expressed some discontent earlier or in another episode with some of the things that DS9 does, but at least you have to admit that by the end of that series, none of the characters are who they were in the pilot.
Oh, absolutely. None of them. Especially Jake Sisko.
But you know what I mean? Like they.
Oh, yeah,
like,
I know what you mean. Yeah.
It made it feel like it mattered.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the decisions they made one day to the next mattered, and that's why when you talk to diehard Star Trek fans, the majority of them are going to choose DS9 over Voyager.
But thanks, Professor Sub-Zero. I'm totally with you on this. Don't let Ben talk you down. Okay, up next, we have a comment from T'Karen Golem, who says, "So, no one's brought up something. I don't really want to bring it up myself. I've been wearing my Staff Allegiance on my sleeve so often that I fear it might tattoo itself onto my arm. So anyone? Sigh. Let's just get this over with. The most cited reason why Vulcans depress their emotions is that their emotions are very powerful and uncontrollable, unless kept under strict control. It is the entire reason Vulcan society is the way it is. This episode seems to completely forget about the major aspect of this major Trek species. Tuvok's emotions seem no more extreme than that of a human. There, I said it, we can all move on. Besides that obvious flaw, this episode is good. Not great, but it lives up to the potential and avoids the many pitfalls that could have ruined it. I mean, this is a delicate subject, and if mishandled, could have been an offensive and or painfully annoying. And Tim Russ gave us a great performance. I say it's good, but it's not really my kind of show. It doesn't capture my sci-fi nerd interest as far as the personal drama. I don't know. I guess I've never been in that situation. I can appreciate how well it's done, but it doesn't speak to me on a personal level. I don't know how to explain it any better. I did want to start a what if it was permanent game. What if Tuvok didn't get his memories back? Well, I'll say that Tuvok would take over as ship's cook and Neelix would become the official ambassador of Voyager. B'Elanna, after completely losing her interest in engineering and getting in touch with her Klingon side, would put in to be the new tactical officer. Janeway would choose to promote Lieutenant Redshirt instead, but she would transfer to security anyway. Seven would be put in charge of engineering. This is where you'd have an interesting contrast. Seven learning to manage a workforce and B'Elanna learning how to get back into grunt work. They would also converse often, so B'Elanna could give her tips and advice, and that's always fun. Finally, Lieutenant Redshirt would meet his timely demise, and B'Elanna would become the new tactical officer. Just a fun idea to throw around. I kind of like that's better than where we're going.
Yeah. But, so you're creating a Tasha Yar and then killing them off pretty quickly.
Exactly.
I like it. You know, I like the what-if game, but that, I mean, that's hours of different directions. Regardless, maintained your staff allegiance continuing.
But tell me that a Star Trek nerd wouldn't spend hours and hours and doing what ifs and enjoy every second of it.
Of course. But we don't have time for that. Let's move on to a comment from Kieran McDuff, who says, okay, having watched this episode for the first time last night, I can actually comment a bit more on it. I definitely saw the parallels with Tuvix, but I reckon this was a stronger episode. The thing that annoyed me about Tuvix was that they effectively reversed out what had happened completely against his will on some flimsy premise that someone had to speak for the individuals as they weren't there that should be Janeway. Okay, what? Anyway.
Someone had to speak for the individuals, and as they weren't there, that person should be Janeway. So, that's what it
means. Okay, I'm sorry to mess up your intonation there. Anyway, here we at least saw Tuvok being the one to make the decision, and he did so in a way that fitted nicely into the story. We also get to see that he hadn't exactly lost what he had experienced with the Sunday's conversation, although as per usual in Voyager, this was never mentioned again afterwards. Probably why I didn't realize I'd missed this episode. The best thing about this episode, though, was that it got to showcase Tim Russ's acting abilities. The childlike Tuvok was very believable, and although the writing obviously played a big part in that, the acting definitely enhanced that. I can't say I have much experience with mental health patients myself, but I do know from other family members who work in that industry that just how difficult it can be and how different the people suffering from mental health issues can be from how they were before anything affected them. Although Tuvok was curable in the end, I still think the episode did an excellent job of conveying the issues. I'm glad I went back to watch this episode. Reset button issues aside, it was still well written, well acted, and didn't leave me disgusted at the actions of the crew like that other Tuvok and Neelix story.
Yeah, a lot of people don't like the ending of Tuvix. Basically, taking it that Janeway basically sentences a sentient being to death. And I don't know, I kind of like it in the fact that it gets conversation going. You know what I mean? I like it when an episode sparks controversy. I think my favorite one being when Sisko poisons the planet of the Maquis to get Eddington.
Right. Ugh.
Which I think is a fantastic episode, by the way.
That's pretty great.
Just the acting in that is top-notch. But
you mentioned conversation starter episodes, and it makes me think back to an earlier episode of Voyager where they made the Cardassian Doctor.
Yeah, that
too. I think that was a great conversation starter.
That's what I like about Star Trek is that, you know, people get angry at certain things that Star Trek does when they're controversial, but I think it shows the power of Star Trek that we're all having a conversation about it. You know what I mean? If people were disinterested, we wouldn't even be discussing and analyzing these things. So it's doing something right, in my opinion.
That's what we're doing. We're growing as a species. You're welcome, Earth.
But we're going to wrap it up. We're going to wrap it up with a very, very brief comment from Carnivore J, who says, finally back, missed you guys. I only wanted to say that I rate this episode 3 out of 5 dead Tuvixes.
Dead Tuvixes. Youch. Oh.
Talk about controversy.
Yeah, you're totally right, though, man. I mean, Tuvix was, I don't want to get back into it. That was a pretty intense episode. But that's that. That is all of our feedback. So let's talk about where the listeners who don't usually give us feedback can get in touch with us.
Yes, you can reach us in a number of different ways, including our email at deltaquadrantpodcast@gmail.com, leaving a comment on our forums at forum.trekmatefamily.com, following us on Twitter at deltaquadrantcast, QADT_cast, and liking us on Facebook at facebook.com/thedeltaquadrant. Gino, I did you a solid last week, and I remembered the Trek radio promo, but since you're here, why don't you do it this time?
You did an excellent job last week, and that's right, folks. It's 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays at trekradio.net. It's a good place to get a lot of your other Trek audio goodness.
I do believe a lot of the representatives are going to be at Star Trek Las Vegas, so maybe me and Ben will be chatting them up.
Yeah, please do. And as always, folks, don't forget to leave those 5-star iTunes reviews. It really helps get the show out there. And now that things are starting to wind down a little bit, we're getting pretty close to the final season of Voyager, it would really help to, you know, let other people know about us, especially because they could marathon and listen to the show start to finish.
Yeah, can you believe we're almost done?
Well, you know, we almost have another year of this to go, so.
Yeah, I think I calculated it out with Melissa's schedule, and given if we don't miss a whole ton of weeks, our end date looks like it's going to be May 2015.
Yeah, we still got some time. So get those iTunes in reviews in while you can.
I like it. I think it's quite fitting that this episode is going to end in the year that's Voyager's 20th anniversary.
How appropriate.
So, until then, we'll see you guys next week and continue to send in those comments.
See ya.
But this was an interesting conversation, and I don't think, or at least I hope I didn't come across as the complainer like I usually do.
No, we were really relatively civil today.
You know. No, Matt, no.
No, I am. Let's be honest, people. If anyone's going to drive listeners away from the Delta Quadrant, it's going to be me and my cynical attitude. I fully admit that. But, you know what? I tried to give fair points to why I don't like particularly care for this episode, but it's still not bad.
Right.
I mean, I wouldn't have given it a 3.5 if it wasn't good in some aspect.
Well, you know, so. I just have to say, I appreciate the fact that we got the kinder, gentler, argumentative Matt today, because I knew that we were going to be in disagreement on some things. So.
Yeah, you were lucky I got 8 hours of sleep, Melissa.
Yep.
Honestly, watching this episode, I didn't feel like there was going to be too much to argue about, really.
See, listeners, when I'm in a less civil mood, as we could put it, just to give you some behind the scenes on the Delta Quadrant, we record this at 9 a.m. on Saturdays, my time. And usually when I'm a little bit shorter, it's because I haven't slept that well. And this is the first thing I'm doing in the morning, so cut me a little bit of slack. I'm not a morning person. But this was fun, and I enjoy talking about this episode. And we got a really interesting episode coming up next week. It's actually one of my favorites of the season. Surprise, surprise, it's another 7 episode. But it's a good one this time. But until then, when we could talk about the Voyager conspiracy. Ooh. This is Matt in Arizona closing Healing Frequencies.
And this is Melissa from North Dakota. Good night, everybody.
And this is Gino in Oklahoma. See you on the other side.
Thanks for listening to the Delta Quadrant. Please join us again next week. Star Trek Voyager and the Voyager theme song are the property of CBS Television Studios, and no infringement is intended.